You are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, October 25th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Barry C. Lynn. He is the director of Open Markets Program at the New America Foundation, author of Cornered, the New Monopoly Capitalism, and the Economics of Destruction. Talk to him about monopolies, what we can see perhaps as an important issue for progressives in the coming year, and of course, AT&T and Time Warner. Also on the program, we may not ever get a Trump presidency, but I'm guessing we will always have Trump TV. Also on the program today, Democrats poised to take the Senate as some Republicans threaten to sue TV stations that run ads linking them to Donald Trump. Also, the Kigali Accord, really an amendment to the Montreal Accord, which is a landmark environmental deal that no one seems to care about.
Ron.
Obamacare premiums looking at a massive price rise in 2017. Chuck Schumer so desperately wants that repatriation bill. Cut corporate taxes. And rest in peace to Tom Hayden, author of the Port Huron Statement, among other things. And lastly, Harvard students are marching for cafeteria workers. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I am back, obviously, from Las Vegas, or at the very least, I'm trying to appear like I am back from Las Vegas. I got called out when I did Hayes on Friday. I mean, he doesn't know why I was still there, but he ended the segment with, "Why are you still in Vegas?" Everybody has left Vegas. Why are you still there? And
'cause it's fun, Chris.
Yeah. I didn't have to tell him about the... Folks, in a fun half today, I will go on at length about how I had my mind blown. On that night, I had a late-night blackjack session because I had the best dealer I've ever had in Las Vegas in blackjack. And this is going to be very controversial for people who have played blackjack before, I think. I was doubling down when I got blackjack against the dealer's six. I mean, that my mind was blown. I know no one cares about that, but my mind was blown. What's that?
I don't know what that means.
I literally could. I had never. I've been playing blackjack for over 25 years. I have never seen anyone ever do that. I had never seen it. Never. Folks, you know what I have also rarely seen? Me looking good in a suit. Even when you see me on TV, what you can't see is that I'm not wearing a full suit.
And it's a little bar mitzvah.
I'm not saying it's a little bit bar mitzvah. Now, I went in and I got my first ever fitting for a custom-made suit. Now, I know what you're thinking. Like, seriously?
Big league.
But did you really? That's a little bit not typical of you, Sam, in terms of both A, trying to look nice, and B, spending that kind of money. Well, they did it as a promotion for this ad. But I will tell you this. It is the suit. I haven't gotten it yet, but I tried it on. It's completely custom. You get to choose like everything from like the size of the lapel to the type of buttons you want to all aspects of the pants, of the pockets on the suit, the interior lining. You get to put something funny stitched in the pocket, which was just for me. This is the inside of my coat. I didn't want to put my initials, but it's Indochino.
Really? SS for Social Security.
Right, exactly. That would have been a good one. Social Security is great. Is one of the largest made-to-measure menswear brands. And they're making it easy for men to get a great fitting, high-quality suits and shirts at incredible prices. You go to Indochino.com, or you can drop by one of their nine, I guess, showrooms in North America. They're a Canadian company. You pick from hundreds of fabrics and patterns. Choose your customizations, like I say, lapels, pleats, jacket linings, all this stuff. You submit your body measurements. And if you're not doing it in store, it's pretty easy to do it at home. You kick back, you relax, and you wait. It takes about 4 weeks for your suit to show up. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389 at Indochino.com. And enter majority at checkout. $389. Now, they send you the suit. If for whatever reason it doesn't fit exactly as you want it to, you send it back with what you need changed. And they do it. It's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. If you go to Indochino.com, enter majority at checkout. Plus, shipping's all free. Indochino.com. You'll never have to worry about badly fitting suits or expensive trips to the tailor again. Get ready to look like $1 million. I got a three-piece suit. I'm getting a vest. I
look like $100,000.
I look, yeah. I mean, for me, it'll be like, you know, $65,000. That's pretty good. Let's play this this quick sound now. Where did my sound sheet go? Oh, yeah. This is yeah. This is what we're seeing now in terms of the Republicans, and when it comes to the polls, and we're moving into the denial stage, the denial phase. Like, this tsunami has been building. People are just staring out at the water, just sort of like, boy, the horizon looks a little weird. And it's now like hitting the bay. And they're still looking there and going, nah, that's just an illusion. Here is Anderson Cooper responding to Scotty Nell Hughes, one of the Trump surrogates, right?
Yes.
And apparently Scotty Nell Hughes has an interesting way of measuring polls. And so far as like, it's not taking into account how many people show up at a small civic center in some place that's completely irrelevant? Where's that being factored in?
The only place that we're hearing that Donald Trump honestly is losing is in the media or these polls that certain ones are putting out. You're not seeing it with the crowd rallies. You're not seeing enthusiasm. You're not seeing it on social media where Donald Trump is 2 to 3 times more than Hillary Clinton on every social media platform. You're not seeing it. So the only place you're hearing that Donald Trump is losing.
What we talked about before, the ground game of turning out people is much more sophisticated.
By the way, I also hear on Twitter that 9/11 was an inside job. That doesn't have to be true.
I'm saying the only place. Just remember, the enthusiasm.
There are UFOs at Area 51.
Well, that we know is true. okay. Time now for a quick break. Oh, please don't tweet me now about this. When we come back, we're going to hear from you.
Yeah, there you have it. Well, first off, I would also add that, and it's quite clear that the Trump campaign bought a ton of Twitter followers. And even when they did their big Facebook thing last night, I ran into today, walking to work, an old friend who happens to know a lot about Facebook Live. And he said, the ratio between shares and views is a little bit weird. I'm sure it did well, but there's no doubt in my mind that the Trump campaign has spent a significant amount of money. Maybe it's not that expensive. I don't know. In buying and creating bot. But even if they didn't, the percentage of people who are on Twitter and the percentage of people who are on Twitter talking about politics is so infinitesimally small that to say that, like, it's just the polls, nobody's measuring what's going on in my apartment.
What I love about that is I really like how Anderson Cooper didn't even...
Yeah, he didn't blink.
He didn't even laugh. He's just like, yeah, I am sort of burning you. But no, seriously. It was kind of like one of those, like, no. I hate you.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Great. Folks, this is an interesting tool. And basically, for this tool to be of relevance to you, you need to have a SQL database. You need to have a SQL database. We don't have one here. Although I've been talking to Kyle, because I think fans.fm has one. But Periscope Data, I was on the phone with these guys for half an hour. And I don't have a lot of use for this because we don't have a SQL database here. And the idea that we could all access it and run these queries, I mean, the amount of time that it would take us, me just to explain it to you, Michael, how to get on the computer.
What?
Periscope Data, it's the ultimate tool for fast and flexible data visualization. Folks, if you've got a company with anywhere from like 1 to 10 employees or 20 to 50 employees or bigger, where you are looking at data and you have your analysts there who are trying to sort of create visualizations of this data and they're having to redo it every day, this is for you. Why run slow queries on old spreadsheet data when Periscope Data allows you to run, visualize, and share analysis over billions of data rows in just seconds? Answer the big questions instead of running routine SQL tasks again and again and again. Periscope Data is fast, powerful, and effortless to connect. They have very blazing fast query execution. They have fast sharing and fast workflow. There's no setup cost or time, and it's easily reversible. It takes one click to disconnect if you decide you want to move forward. You don't want to move forward with the whole deal. It's plug and play for immediate use and immediate values. You can analyze your data 150 times faster. Charts and dashboards are always up to date. Periscope Data is a powerful and intuitive tool that will bring your SQL analysis to the next level. You can get a free trial today by going to www.periscopedata.com/majority. That's periscopedata.com/majority. Check it out. Definitely worth a checkout. One of the things that we're going to be talking about, and now I think, like, you know, now is the time to start talking about what we're going to be talking about, not just after the election, but into the new year. Which isn't to say that anybody should get overconfident or not vote or whatnot. But now is the time. That's why we're going to have Barry Lynn on, because this is going to be, this is like, you've noticed, if you've been following Elizabeth Warren, this is what she's been talking about, anti-monopoly stuff. So this is one of the things I've been thinking about as of late, is like, you know, what we should be doing with the show now. In addition, I'm also in the fun half, I'm going to talk about, I asked a question of Jill Stein of the Green Party, specifically a strategic one.
And, nailed it.
Well, we'll see what.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah. As you know, I was in Vegas last week. I did Haze from a strip mall in Vegas. This is where they do. I know it's strange. That's not the way I went. That's not what I meant. I went on his program. As soon as I went on, I got the tweet. I don't even know who tweets me this about Harry's. And it's great. Harry's retweeted it. So anytime you see me on television with a clean shaven face, you should tweet at Harry's and thank them. Because as you know, when I shave with Harry's, and I look good, I think. I don't know.
A little defensive.
I'm not gonna.
I think so.
I mean, I look at least I'm shaven.
Yes.
Harry's five-blade razors now include softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places, lubricating strip, textured handle for more control when it's wet. Still just $2 a blade. You're not paying $4 a blade. You're not paying for hard plastic, whatever the heck that, I don't know. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they're going to send you their popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, 1 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel free when you sign up for a shave plan. Just pay the shipping. Plus, there's a special offer for fans of the show. Enter code MAJORITYREPORT. Code is MAJORITYREPORT at checkout and get a post-shave balm added to your order for free. Go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout. Claim your free trial set and post-shave balm. It's harrys.com, code Majority Report. All right, we're going to take a break. Don't forget, it's your membership that makes this show possible. Members get the show commercial free. So that's just another added bonus to being a member. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Barry C. Lynn, the director of open markets from New America, on monopolies, antitrust, AT&T, and Time Warner. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Barry C. Lynn. He directs the Open Markets Program and is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He is author of Cornered, The New Monopoly, Capitalism and Economics of Destruction, published in 2010. Barry, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, let's talk. I mean, obviously, there's the idea of corporate concentration is in the news with this AT&T and Time Warner. But before we get there, I want to start very broadly, if we can. Just give us an idea of what we mean when we mean monopoly in this country.
What we mean when we mean monopoly is we mean that a company, a corporation, a private enterprise of some sort has captured sufficient control over a marketplace to determine how business is done in that marketplace. And that doesn't, that means you don't have to have 100%, you don't have to have 80%. You know, sometimes you can do that with 50%, sometimes you can do that with 30%. If everyone else is really small, you become the dominant player. So monopoly means being powerful enough to basically determine what takes place in the market, and so you're actually not part of the market.
So will you give us some examples? I mean, start with the one about eyeglasses, because this one drives me nuts, because I've been a glasses wearer for a long time, and it's expensive. It's really really expensive to buy glasses.
Yeah, no, that's a it's a great example, and it's one of the ones that is sort of hidden in plain sight, in a sense. And, you know, just to give you a sense of, like, how the eyeglass market in the United States is structured, you know, if you go shopping for eyeglasses, you know, you see all these different companies out there, all these different retailers. You see LensCrafters, you see Pearle Vision, you see, you know, back in Target, they have an optical division. And in the Macy's store, they have an optical division. And basically all of those retailers are all owned by the same company called Luxottica. You know, Luxottica is this Italian manufacturer of eyeglasses that rolled up control over a huge part of the retailing business in the United States. And they did so that they could force these retailers to sell their product. It's a great way to vertically integrate and create a real monopoly and force your product on the people at the price that you set. And it's not only those companies, though, not only those retailers, but if you go into all these like independent boutiques that you see around town, then, you know, the fancy little boutique out in the fancy mall, almost always, pretty much always, you're going to be dealing with Luxottica products because they are also the dominant manufacturer of high-end wear. So you see all these different brands on your eyeglasses, but behind those brands, you know, which are some of the fanciest designers in the world, behind those brands is Luxottica that's building those frames to sell to you behind all these different names, one company.
And I mean, how is it that this is allowed? I mean, in this, like, you know, this, you know, in 96, we had the Telecommunications Deregulation Act that was passed. And at that time, I was in show business. And so it had a big impact. And all of a sudden, you had networks, television networks that could produce their own product. And before they couldn't. I mean, it seems to me like this glasses situation, I want to talk about other examples, but it seems to me this glasses situation is sort of like a perfect example of they own both, maybe they don't own all of it, but they own the vast majority of distribution mechanisms and they own everything that needs to be distributed. It seems problematic. I mean, and I know it is insofar as like the glasses I'm wearing cost me like a grand.
Yeah, no, it's a giant ripoff system. America has become a giant ripoff system. And the reason this happened is it's very simple. I mean, it's like we used to have really great anti-monopoly law in this country. In fact, America was pretty much founded in an action against monopoly. You know, the real Tea Party back in 1773 was a rebellion against the British East India Company. And it was a political rebellion. It wasn't by consumers. It was people saying, I want the freedom to make a market with my neighbors without a giant intermediary telling us how to do that. You know, that. So you had Sam Adams and you had John Hancock saying that this company, British East India Company, is a threat to our liberties. So the revolution was a revolution in large part against monopoly. And that's what America was built on in the 19th century and the 20th century with anti-monopoly, keeping companies small. And the cases where you had really big companies or you had a network like a railroad or a telephone company, making sure that the power in that railroad or that telephone company was neutral. It couldn't be used to concentrate political power. So that's how it worked in this country. And we did a pretty good job of keeping our economy open and democratic for 200 years, the only exception being during the period of the plutocrats, the first plutocrats, more than a century ago. But then it all got overturned in the beginning of the Reagan administration. And as you have already touched on, the Clinton administration, the first Clinton administration, was pretty much, you know, job one of it, the first Clinton administration was, how do we create monopolies? How do we, you know, help the rich folks create monopolies or rip off the rest of the rest of us?
So, all right. So let's, my presumption is the Sherman Antitrust Act and the, as it was amended over the years, I guess in the Clayton Act and others, that Was this the primary source of, I guess, legal authority to maintain, or I should guess, to prevent monopolies?
Yeah, I mean, the Sherman Act, which was, goes back to 1890, that was the federalization of anti-monopoly. Before that, people had been radical anti-monopolists, but they had used their state legislatures. So it's like going back to the beginning, America has been engaged, Americans have been engaged in anti-monopolism, breaking up monopolies from, you know, from day one of this country. But what happened is in the 1890s, the big companies were escaping. They were like leveraging different states off each other. They were paying off the state legislature in one place in order to screw the folks in another state. And then so the Americans got to go to, hey, we need to actually create federal laws. The state laws are no longer sufficient. And so that's what Sherman Act was. But so, you know, again, we've been doing this for 200 years. And then what the Reagan people did is they changed the philosophy behind our anti-monopoly. You know, anti-monopoly for 200 years, the basic idea was we are going to protect ourselves as citizens against the concentration of power and control. We're going to protect our liberties. We're going to protect our democracy. And then what happened in the early 1980s is a bunch of folks from the libertarian Chicago School of Economics got to power with Reagan, and they said, you know what? That's all wrong. That's inefficient. What we need to do is use our anti-monopoly laws to promote efficiency in the name of the consumer. And so they changed the whole body of law to reflect that new goal, that new philosophy. And then it changed how all of those laws work. And you run that out for 35 years and you end up in a world in which pretty much every single marketplace in America today is monopolized. It's gained. So, healthcare.
So help us understand how that change in philosophy, how it's actually applied in such a way that led to this. And am I right in thinking that much of this anti-monopoly, I guess, or anti-anti-monopoly philosophy was promoted by Robert Bork? Right. I mean, didn't he in the late 70s, like right as Reagan was coming to office, had a sort of a, I guess, a seminal book that outlined this idea?
Yes, exactly. Robert Bork published a book in 1978 called The Antitrust Paradox. And the antitrust paradox, as Robert Bork defined it, was that, golly, you know, we've been using these laws to promote democracy. We've been using these laws to promote your liberty as a farmer to have a marketplace into which you can sell your grain. It's your liberty as a small business person to have a marketplace in which to sell your enterprise. And what he came along and said, that's inefficient. That's leading to it's making it harder to produce goods at scale to help us as consumers. So what we need to do is simplify this whole body of law so that the only thing it aims to help is us as consumers. So he took out, you know, the point of anti-monopoly is fundamentally political. It's to protect our democracy from concentration of control, concentration of power by the people who compile mass amounts of wealth. And what the Chicago schoolers came along and said is, no, that's all wrong. I mean, that's preventing the rich people from helping us become more materially wealthy. So they changed that philosophy and look at, you know, jump ahead 3 decades and what do we have today? We have a few people with massive piles of wealth, and they're using those massive piles of wealth to subvert our democracy. They're using their corporate enterprises to restrict us and control us and tell us what to do every day.
And do you think,
so
I mean,
what is that threat? People have to understand, this is really important. It's like people have to understand what is at threat today in America. It's not simply that they're ripping us off by selling $1,000 pair of eyeglasses. It's that they are taking our democracy, and this is how they're doing it. It's actually really simple. We all know it. All the people that are voting for Trump know it. Not all of them, but many of them. A lot of the people that voted for Sanders, for Bernie, they understand that something's wrong. But the people don't understand what went wrong. But we can actually trace it back. And what went wrong is that 35 years ago, we changed how we do anti-monopoly law. And we let the rich do whatever it is that they want to do. And now they're doing it to us.
All right. I want to just put a pin in this sort of the progression from a plutonomy to a plutocracy, which is basically, it seems, what you're arguing there. But I want to stay with the monopoly paradox. On its own terms, did that even happen though? I mean, like first, like the idea is, and it's sort of ironic. Well, I guess maybe it isn't. I mean, this libertarian notion of we don't want the government to centrally plan anything, but we're perfectly happy to have, you know, one company centrally plan it all for us, at least in their sphere, right? But did it, and that's not terribly, I guess, distinct from, you know, sort of what I guess those libertarians at Mount Pelerin were contemplating. But what on its own terms, did that even happen? I mean, if the idea is that it's just going to make it more efficient, and I'm going to get better glasses. It doesn't seem to me like that happened even on those terms.
No, it did not happen on those terms. And your glasses example is a perfect example of how that did not happen. There's a new book out there by a guy, an antitrust economist named John Cuoca, who looks at this whole frame on its own terms. And he shows that it's not working. It's growth. It's like it's failing grotesquely, basically. So even on its own terms, it's not working. But you know what? Because all of this wealth that these people have concentrated gives them so much political power, and the size and magnitude of the corporations they have under their control is such that it gives them the ability to control our lives on a day-to-day basis. They don't really necessarily care at this point that we have outed them, that they were lying even on their initial promise, the most fundamental promise. Because, you know, they now have the power with which to tell us what to do unless we aim immediately, directly at the heart, at the root of their power, which is their monopoly.
So, all right. So walk us through this. I mean, it's clear how they amass these massive fortunes, right? I mean, we look at guys like Jeff Bezos, for instance, or I guess, you know, a guy like Bill Gates to a certain extent, obviously. And who are others whose domination in the marketplace has translated into an oversized, I mean, you know, Bill Gates, I guess there is some disagreement in terms of what kind of force he's been in education. I happen to think it's not been a positive one. But certainly this guy's had an outsized influence in our education system and reform over the past decade. Where else do we see that dynamic take place where the massive amounts of wealth that's been able to be built by controlling an industry or a market has translated into an oversized political power?
Walton family, Koch family, just, you know, you kind of go down the list of folks at the top of the, you know, Forbes richest. You know, and it's important to understand that there's two stages in this monopoly problem that we've seen arise over the last 35 years. And the first stage was after the change in law back in the early 1980s, we saw the explosion of giant retailers, of giant agricultural companies. You know, so that's when you see Walmart really become massively big. The changes in law allow them to become, these companies become much, much, much bigger than any company in the previous generation. And you jump ahead to today, and the Walton family, they have, as a family, you know, the six heirs to Sam Walton have as much wealth as the lower, you know, 140 million Americans combined. One family with as much wealth as 140 million Americans. That is political power. And that is a direct result of changes in anti-monopoly law that allowed them to take a little tiny, you know, small retailer and turn it into a 5,000 unit retailer that dominates retail, storefront retail across America. Stage two of the monopoly problem is due to the internet. That's when you see the rise of companies like Amazon, you mentioned Jeff Bezos, of Google, of Facebook. And these companies, this sort of revolution in technology has allowed these new companies to come in and intermediate in between us in ways that no previous company was able to. These are kind of like the railroads of the 21st century. And Google, Amazon, Facebook, think railroad, and you begin to understand what these corporations are in today's world. And so these companies are, they've emerged into this deregulated atmosphere, and they're doing things that no railroad is ever allowed to do. And now we're seeing the rise of this whole second generation of monopolists who are richer and more powerful than the first generation. Walmart, as powerful as they are really terrifically scared of Amazon. That's how powerful Amazon is.
And so, and then this influence extends into every facet of our lives. And I also, I want to get to sort of its implications for like patent policy and corporate governance. But the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, the act that repealed Glass-Steagall, is a similar sort of just increasing of monopolies. I mean, it definitely seems arguable as to whether or not somewhat obvious that the financial crisis could have only been as devastating because of the concentration and the creation of these monopolies within our financial sector.
Well, finance is part of it. I mean, you know, I think people after the crash of 08 overplayed the role of finance. It's the combination of concentrated capital and combined with immensely powerful corporations, which are political institutions with which you reach out into the world and do things and control people. So, you know, in terms of the history, you mentioned the deregulation of finance. That, you know, it's like, again, it's like this happened in two stages. Stage one was under Reagan, when playing from the Bork playbook, they came in and they changed the philosophy of anti-monopoly as it applied to the antitrust division of the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission. Stage two happened under Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton came in and he applied the libertarian philosophy to all of these specifically regulated areas like banking, like media, as you mentioned earlier, like energy, like the defense industrial complex. One of the very first things he did was allow massive consolidation in the defense industrial complex. He promoted it. And he did it also with trade. Understanding what the WTO is, the WTO is basically allowing for monopolies to arise in the international space. Before that, trade was used to fight monopoly, trade policy. So stage two of this was the Clinton people basically going into each of these specific regulatory regimes and undoing the mechanisms of protection of democracy and liberty that had been put into place over 200 years.
What were some of those? What were some of those undoings?
Well, like I said, it's like media, banking, the energy sector, you know, the trade sector, the defense industrial complex. These are all sort of regulated in different ways. And then, you know, so they went in and took all of those areas on. The important thing is that we are in. There's two things to take away from this. Number one, in the United States, we are in a worse situation than we were more than 100 years ago with the plutocrats of the Gilded Age, because the folks today have more power than those guys did. Rockefeller, Carnegie, Morgan did not have spy systems that gathered information the way that the folks that run Google, Amazon, Facebook do. They could not even dream of having something like that. They didn't have the political power that these people do. That's the point one that we have to understand. Point two is that we can win this. We're actually, for the first time, making real headway in Washington and getting people, policymakers in this town, to understand that this is a problem. It is a major problem. It's probably the number one problem that we face, and that we can actually do something about it. In fact, we had a huge victory recently when Renata Hess, who is the acting assistant attorney general for antitrust, she did a speech back in September in which she said, this whole Bork approach to antitrust, we're throwing that out. We're not doing that anymore. We're not doing consumer welfare anymore. We're not doing efficiency anymore. That's a huge intellectual victory for us. It doesn't deal with the power structure as it has been created, but it's a first step to being able to deal with this massive concentration of power. First, you have to see it, and you have to understand its origins. So now people see it, and they understand its origins. And that's the first step to being able to take it on.
All right, so give me a sense of what. What should we be looking for, as assuming that there is a second Clinton administration? I'm going to assume that Donald Trump is not going to be it's not part of his agenda to reverse the any type of Bork doctrine on antitrust. But assuming that we have a second Clinton administration, what should we be looking for in terms of, like, personnel in terms of the executive branch? And what should we be looking for on the legislative side as this slow process of, at the very least, a broader intellectual understanding of the failure of the antitrust regime we've had for now almost, I guess, 40 years, almost 35 yeah. years. I mean, so what should we be looking for? And then, you know, how do people, is this something that we just have to watch, or is there something, I mean, how do normal people get involved in something like this?
Yeah. No, I mean, so, you know, the Hillary people have said, thus far, really good things. They admit that we have a huge monopoly problem in the United States. They are saying that this is one of the main sources, if not the main source, for all the inequality that everyone sees around us. So they are saying that we need to radically change how we enforce these laws. So they're admitting that we have a problem, and they're saying they're going to do something about it. And that is fantastic. Now, you know, next step, next question is, are they serious? You know, I think they're serious because, to some degree, they're serious because they know that there are folks now, unlike, say, 8 years ago when President Obama took power, who are paying attention. President Obama made some pretty good promises, and he did not act on a single one of them when it came to monopoly. At that time, there wasn't really any group that were watching over him. Now we have Senator Warren watching over the coming Clinton administration. We have Senator Sanders watching over. We have Senator Franken. We have folks like Senator Mike Lee, a Republican from Utah, who's really concerned about these issues. So we're in a very different situation in the Senate, and that's going to affect the actions of the Clinton administration. So, but my sense is that they're going to resist taking on certain companies. One of the main groups of companies that they're going to be very reticent to take on are the ones that are most dangerous. And those are the Silicon Valley companies, the platform monopolists. So you said, what do we need to watch for? I said, there's two things that we need to watch for. And number one is the Hillary Clinton administration doing anything to take on the power and the the actions of the Silicon Valley companies. And then number two, you asked for a name of someone we should, you know, like, in terms of people going into office. I'll give you one name, someone we should watch out, see if this person gets into power or not. His name is Gary Gensler. He's been one of the top advisors to the campaign. He was the head of the CFTC in the first 4 years of the Obama administration. He's a banker from Wall Street, but he is a fantastic reformer. He is a true reformer. He's someone who got real things done in his job at the CFTC.
And Gensler was a big surprise, I think, for activists. I mean, people did not anticipate. There was a lot of questions when he was made the head of the CFTC, which is the Commodities Future Trading Commission. And
exactly.
He surprised a lot of people, I think.
Yeah. And now, so he's, you know, people have been really happy that he's been inside the mix during the campaign. We're starting to hear rumors that he is not going to get a top level position, which is what people have been expecting.
That he's not, or he is?
Yeah, that's what we're starting to hear rumors. So that would be a very important early test. You know, in terms of, do we need to bring real pressure to bear against the Hillary administration, the second Clinton administration? If Gary Gensler doesn't get a job, a very high level job in the next administration, that's pretty much a proof that we're going to have to bring real pressure to bear. And that leads me to the last year questions, which is, what can people do about it? And what people can do is bring the pressure to bear. And we can bring the pressure to bear in all these different ways. We can bring the pressure to bear through phone calls. We can bring the pressure to bear through giving money to the right organizations. We can bring the pressure to bear by marching in the street. You can bring the pressure to bear, as we have done thus far, by, you know, standing up people like Bernie. Like, you know, I mean, Trump, you know, turned out to be kind of a whack job, but, you know, there was some points at which he was actually seemed like he might be standing up to concentrated power. You know, there was Occupy, there was the Tea Party. If people stand up, they can actually have a real effect on what's going on. But if we sit back and just assume that Hillary's going to do what she, you know, that whatever she does, it's kind of up to her to do it, we're not going to get done what we need to do.
Lastly, let me ask you just one more question on that sort of the platform monopolies. Is that what there seems to be a sort of a second front that anti-monopoly folks are working on, and that's sort of hit these tech companies via Europe? Just give us a brief look at that.
Yes, I mean, the thing about these companies is the one very important leverage that we do have over these corporations is not through our own government, but through governments abroad. Because these corporations are global in nature, because they have they expand into so many different countries, they are exposed to the regulatory powers of other countries that are not, in which the anti-monopoly philosophy and the anti-monopoly apparatus has not been as corrupted as in the United States. The most important of those countries where this kind of enforcement is still being really brought to bear is the European Union.
Barry, could you just back off your phone just a little bit? You're getting a little bit muffled. Sorry.
Yeah. So in the European Union, I think we're going to see some, we've already seen some really great action by Margaret Vestager, who's the Director General of Competition over there. And we're going to see, very likely, we're going to see significant additional action against Google, Facebook, Amazon by the European Union. And that's something that people should really support in the United States. The Obama administration has strongly opposed what the European Union has done to the Silicon Valley companies. That is precisely the wrong thing to do. But that just tells you where the Obama administration stands vis-a-vis the Silicon Valley companies. But we, as average American citizens, should strongly support these efforts by the Europeans to regulate these corporations, because they're actually also helping protect democracy here in America by doing that. They're helping to protect our liberties here in America by doing that.
All right. And lastly, just quickly, I mean, I think people can anticipate your thoughts on the AT&T Time Warner deal that is in the works. Is there something that is particularly problematic about this? I mean, where do you hope this dies? Or where do you anticipate, or what do you anticipate its chances of happening?
Well, excuse me. I mean, what's wrong with it is, and you actually touched on this right at the beginning of this conversation, when you mentioned how in the 1996 reforms, the networks back then, which were ABC, NBC, CBS, were allowed to take over the production of content, of television shows. They were allowed to vertically integrate into the production of content. And that was a really early version of that, but there's a simple rule, and this goes back to the origins of this country. And we applied it to railroads, and we applied it to the telegraph, and we applied it to electrical utilities, and we applied it to cinemas, and we applied it to the networks. And the simple rule is that you who supply a vital service, you who are in control of a vital infrastructure of distribution, you should not also be in the business of creating the content. You should not be competing with the people who are trying to create other content. There should be a real marketplace there. So no vertical integration. That was the rule. So when they changed the law in 1996, that was a big problem. And since then, it has only become much, much, much worse. The 2011 merger between Comcast and NBC, between a cable company and a company that makes content, was a real disaster. So the reason that, one of the reasons, there's a number of reasons we should oppose the AT&T Time Warner, but one of the reasons is that AT&T is still mainly a distribution company. What we need to do is draw the line now between any further mergers between distribution networks and content providers. And we need to begin to undo those that have been done already. We should be talking about undoing the merger between Comcast and NBC. That's where we need to move the discussion.
Barry Lynn, director of the Open Markets Program, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, author of Cornered, the New Monopoly, Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. You get an extra anywhere from 45 minutes. I mean, we never do that anymore, but maybe we'll try and exert some discipline.
Double that, usually.
To an hour and a half of material on a daily basis. And, you know, special bonus content that we don't give the freebies, like some of the debate stuff we didn't give to the freebies. And also, you get it commercial free. So check it out. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, if you're going to buy crap from Amazon, these monopolists, the least you can do is to give us a kickback by going to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on that link, bookmark it. We take a piece of their insane revenue.
Going off,
or you could go
cliff to
jet.com, who apparently were recently acquired by Walmart because they're so afraid of Amazon.
Walmart's a nice mom and pop store.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's something at least. But if you go to majorityreportkickback.com, you can also click on our jet.com link. We should just open up our own store. Yeah. Well, give us a review on iTunes if you want. That helps. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. Take your IMs.